I'm not good at whistling.
Yeah, I can't whistle either. Is that the Swarm theme song?
Yeah, it's the Andy Griffith Swarm.
Oh man, a swarm of Andy Griffiths? That is
truly
terrifying.
A swarm of Don Knotts. That's what's scary.
This is The End User, episode 187 for Thursday, November 20th. Andy Griffith, Futurist Prime. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Mon.
And Taylor, just to start off the news here, we kind of forgot to talk about something last week. I said we had you covered, but we missed out on Google Inbox a little bit.
Did we not talk about Google Inbox at all?
No, we didn't.
Okay, wow. Well, yeah, I just, it is a thing that exists now. And,
well, sort of.
I feel like a bad futurist. I signed up right away for the beta. I still haven't received my invite.
Yeah, I realized that I, in fact, had not done that, and I corrected that tonight and signed up. Now, it was weird to sign up for the invite because you request the invite. You have to, like, you go to the page, and it's like, oh, just email this other email, and, you know, something will happen, I guess. So.
Yeah, I used my the Digital Media Zone credentials to try to cozy up an invite, but no dice so far.
Yeah, yeah. So I'd imagine it'll be a little while before that all that filters through. So let's talk a little bit about what this thing is. Are you excited about it? Does this solve a problem that you have?
I don't really feel like it does, but maybe it does, right? Maybe I'm using email a lot worse than I think I am.
Could be.
And maybe Google's priority inbox is not helping me as much as I think it does. And so maybe their inbox would help even more. So I'm starting to kind of get that sense from this article we have from Boy Genius Report, talking about the seven best features of Google Inbox.
Yeah, I think it's kind of an interesting thing because I really just don't get that much email. So having the ability to kind of super sort my email just isn't that big a deal for me. But I know there are a lot of people out there that are totally inundated with email. And I feel like for those kind of people that this could be a good kind of solution for them. So what it kind of does, again, having not used it and having my request out there, is that it adds a bunch of features kind of to replace Gmail as a traditional email provider. They're almost reimagining how an inbox should look. And obviously from the name, I guess they call it inbox, right? But they just allow you to get all of this kind of super sorting into place. So you can sort things into like travel, and Microsoft is doing a little bit of this with Outlook.com as well, but you can sort things into like travel and like deals and that kind of thing. And you basically get a proliferation of different inboxes that have different kinds of content in it, and you can choose to go to each different kind of inbox.
Yeah, it almost seems like Facebook's paper app, right?
Yeah,
that sort of sorts your friends' posts into personal posts and then news stories from different sections, but for your inbox instead. It's pretty strange. I still don't understand it, but like I said, I feel like there might be something there that I just won't get until I use it. But you know what my favorite feature of inbox is, Chris?
What's that?
It's not one that I've experienced firsthand, but when it described to me, it filled me with glee. So if you have a Google account and an Android phone and you've been accepted into the inbox beta and you have another account that's not a Google email or a Gmail email, then under Android 5.0 Lollipop, you are now forced to use Google Inbox for your Gmail account, but you have to use Android's built-in Gmail app for your other email accounts. So you go to Gmail, you go to Inbox for your Gmail, and you go to Gmail for your other email.
Okay.
I just think that's hilarious.
Yeah, that is pretty weird.
I'm sure they'll fix it eventually. Like maybe they'll allow Android users to use Inbox for everything, or maybe they'll rename Gmail into just email. But if you have Android and Gmail and another email and Inbox, well, you do exactly what I said, and you get very confused, just like I almost did trying to tell you the anecdote.
I've got it in my head. What they're going to do is, and this is something I'm making up off the top of my head, is they are going to rename Inbox to Gmail, and then they're going to rename Gmail to Swarm.
Well, wouldn't people get confused between Swarm and Swarm then?
Well, yeah, but that's just but a side effect.
Well, a side effect is better than a lake effect.
So anyway, you know, I guess we can't talk about it that in depth. I think it really is, like you said, a product you have to kind of use to understand what it means. So,
and that is I feel like it's the tagline of every review of Inbox that I've read so far.
Yeah. So we'll have to kind of wait until we actually get our hands on it. But I just at least wanted to mention that it's out there and it's something that we're looking forward to getting to use, and as soon as we get to use it, we'll kind of see what it looks like. So, cool stuff. So let's get into a Nokia announcement. This is not a Microsoft announcement that is from Nokia. This is a Nokia announcement from Nokia.
Oh, so it must be some sort of software or services related announcement, right?
Yeah, they're making an app called Swarm. Not really. So, no, this is
everyone making an app called Swarm, Chris?
Yes. In fact, I have an app called Swarm now.
Do you? What does it do?
Yeah, it's in the Windows Phone Marketplace.
Uh-huh.
It just says the word Swarm on the screen. That's all.
That's great. Mine's a flashlight, actually.
Oh, good. Oh, no. Sorry, mine's a level. That's what it should be.
That's a good use for Swarm.
The hello world of mobile apps. At least for the computer scientist people out there that I know there are many of. So anyway, Nokia proper is announcing a tablet. And just to back up a little bit, you know, Nokia split off some of its company into Microsoft, and not quite all
yes,
of
the
it.
Part, the part that makes hardware is now Microsoft.
Right.
So how is Nokia making hardware?
Well, I'm sure they still have some competency in making hardware. I mean, this device
actually
looks pretty
nice. Do they? Because that should all be in Microsoft. I feel like Microsoft could sue over the fact that Nokia is still making hardware.
Maybe. But so this is the Nokia, the hand of Nokia that went off in a different direction, and they're going into Android land instead of Windows Phone land. You know, when they made the...
Well, Microsoft will definitely sue over that.
Right. Well, they actually, they'll get royalties from the patents that they have that Android uses. So.
Then I guess they don't have to sue.
Has already occurred. So anyway, this tablet that they're announcing is called the N1 tablet, and it's a 7.9-inch IPS screen. It's 2048 by 1536. Taylor, does that sound familiar?
Yes, it sounds exactly like the dimensions of the iPad and the iPad Mini.
Yeah.
So in fact, it's the same screen size as the iPad Mini. In fact, it looks exactly like an iPad Mini.
It does, and I think that's a compliment, honestly.
Well, the iPad Mini is nearly as minimal as a tablet can get, at least the second and third generations before they added the Touch ID, which even that is not very unminimal.
Right. So, yes, this is a 4x3 screen, and it looks exactly like an iPad Mini. It's a dead ringer. Right.
Can we agree that 4x3 is really the way to go for a multi-purpose tablet? It's Google's doing it now. Apple has always been doing it. Microsoft didn't do it, and now they're saying that the Surface is not a tablet. And now Nokia is doing it.
Yeah, I think that won the battle, right? The compromises that come with 4x3 are acceptable, given that you probably don't watch 16x9 media that often. You do other stuff more often, right? So having a 16x9 like the Surface is, the original Surface, is a little bit awkward to use in some ways. And, In the past, I definitely thought that it was cool that the 16:9 tablet in the Surface was a good thing to have, but I'm reconsidering that. I think 4:3 has won at this point in time.
Well, for me personally, I mean, most of my screens are 4:3 or 16:9 or maybe 16:10, and now I've just got the iPad that's 4:3, and I find a strange delight in watching old television shows, which were filmed and broadcast in 4:3, on the iPad, right? It's almost as if it was designed for this. I can watch movies and stuff on my big screens and my small screens and my new shows on my iPhone, but when it comes to old TV shows, I get to watch them on my iPad, and it's nice.
Yeah, Andy Griffith was seeing into the future that the iPad would be a television-consuming device, and they filmed in 4:3 specifically for the iPad.
I've always said that Andy Griffith was a visionary, a technological genius visionary, the Steve Jobs of his time.
Right. I think, he was the futurist prime, as it were.
The primest.
The primest, yeah. So here's an interesting bit. So the chip in there is not an ARM chip. It's a quad-core Intel Atom Z3580. So do we think
We've been seeing more and more Atom chips as they come into maturity, seeing them in devices like this.
Yeah, and we've seen there was a Windows tablet a while back that was using Atom, and it was supposed to be relatively competent, and I expect the same thing from this. I think Intel has finally managed to get something competent in the mobile space in a way that they just haven't been able to do yet. I guess they have been able to do it because they've had previous tablets with it, but I feel like this is a different class of device than those other tablets. It's Intel Atom quad core. We've got it's a 2.3 gigahertz chip. We've got all the stuff you would expect, Bluetooth 4.0, the 802.11 AC is nice to see, so you get gigabit Wi-Fi, as it were. To round out the specs, we've got an 8-megapixel front camera and a 5-megapixel rear camera, and we've got Android 5.0, which is Lollipop, of course, and it comes with a version, it is just Lollipop, and what it does is it ships with Nokia's custom launcher they're calling Z Launcher. So,
well, at least it's a launcher and not a skin. That's a little bit better.
Absolutely. That is done correctly, I think. It's definitely a good thing to provide a launcher instead of a skin. That we can at least say that. So the interesting thing is that they're launching Z Launcher. I think I just recursed over myself somehow. But they're launching the Z Launcher not only for Nokia phones. They're for any Android phone out there, I assume there's some minimum spec, but they're launching it for everybody. So they are launching the phone with this pre-installed, but anybody can go to the Play Store and try it out.
Well, that's kind of nice.
Yeah.
Do you know about the Z Launcher?
Yeah, so it's I don't have a Android phone to try this out on currently, but from the screenshots I can see here, it's a home screen that has the temperature at the top and then kind of a list of apps, right? And what they're trying to do is they're using some kind of predictive technology where they try to figure out what you're about to do and they float the thing you're about to do to the top of the list. So, for example, they gave an example where if you call your mother every day while going home from work, which is a little weird, but I'll run with it, then it will float the contact card for your mother up to the top of the screen.
Oh, I see. So it's predictive. Now, what if you want to do something that is not in its top predictions, for what it thinks you're going to do?
Yeah, well, then you have to do the usual thing and swipe through some menus to get to the apps.
Well, apparently, if you don't want to do that, you can just draw a letter onto the screen, and it will start predicting things of that letter that you want to do.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, nobody wants to do that, so. I've seen so many apps try to say, oh, well, you just draw the letter on the screen, and I think it's just, as a user experience, that's absolutely ridiculous, and I don't think anyone would actually do that seriously, but
hey, if I learned graffiti as a whole new written language for Palm, I think I can draw a letter on the screen with my finger. Don't don't disparage me this, even though I'm never going to use this app.
Yeah, I remember there was even a there was a plugin for a programming tool called Eclipse, you know, that you write code into. And they said, oh, well, if you just draw a letter into the screen, it'll do this for you. And it's like, what? Like, I have a mouse? It's just totally crazy.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm never going to write with my mouse. That's crazy.
No, definitely don't do that. But I don't know. It just seems like an ancillary way to do something. And I think they're kind of grasping at straws with that feature. But the predictive stuff does seem pretty neat. I kind of like the idea of, well, instead of having me arrange my home screen in a way that makes sense for me, just have the phone realize what I'm about to do and put the right app under my thumb. I think that makes a ton of sense. So I at least like that first bit of it.
Yeah, I agree. That's pretty cool. I mean, all of this seems pretty nice. I don't have an Android phone. I'm not going to try it. I don't know what else is out there to compare it to. I like the interface of my iPhone just fine.
Yeah.
But so, I would welcome other options.
So Anthony Rayner in the chat there said that he tried it last night and he immediately uninstalled it. So he says the list is too short and the prediction was bad.
How did you let it predict anything?
He said it didn't predict what I wanted most of the time. So I'd imagine
you'd have to learn.
Yeah, you'd have to give it a while to have it learn what you're trying to do. But yeah, the list being too short, that you're right. It is, because what is it, like maybe six apps from the screenshot? That's not a very long list. So if it gets it wrong within the tolerance of six apps, then, you know, it's wrong, and then you have to go dig into the menu to get whatever you want to get.
Yeah, one out of six, it should be able to guess right away.
Right. So now
it shouldn't be that hard.
You do, at least, just like with any Android launcher for the most part, you get icons at the bottom like Chrome and Google Maps and calling and that kind of stuff. So for really common stuff like that, you do get a shortcut for that. So
Well, that sounds like every other home screen or launcher.
Yes,
that's just
yes,
normal.
Pretty much. Yeah, so I like the hardware. You know, I'm unsure that the Z launcher will get a whole ton of traction, but the hardware on the N1 tablet seems to be pretty handsome to me. So I think they've got a pretty good device there.
Yeah, but if I were considering the Nokia N1, I would more strongly consider an iPad mini.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, it depends on if you're an Android or iOS kind of person, I guess.
That's true. If you're an Android person, you should get the iPad mini. If you're an iOS person, you should get the iPad mini.
Yeah, well, I think we can say that just about any platform in this day and age is pretty good. These platforms have gotten really mature in a way they just haven't in the past.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think Lollipop is great. I'm very impressed with it.
Yeah. I need to spend some more time with Lollipop. It's really looking impressive to me.
Well, I think we need to spend some more time with the Afterburners. What do you think, Chris?
I think so. Do you have your seatbelt fastened?
Oh, no, but let's continue.
Okay. Well, you do that, and I'll kick us off. So Google has released an update to their Google Keep app, which is basically like a to-do list on steroids, and they've added some real-time kind of Google Drive-like collaboration to the app, so that seems like a pretty cool thing. You know, we use Google Drive to compile the show notes, so if you can have a kind of collaborative to-do list between, you know, perhaps your family or something like that, I feel like that's a pretty good use case for this kind of app. So, yeah, they've added real-time collaboration to Google Keep, and I think that could be a winner for families out there.
Yeah, this is great. Reminders for iOS has some things like this, but the real question is, when will Google Keep merge with Inbox?
Right, and they'll call it Swarm. So Google's released a new version of Chrome number 39. They fixed a bunch of security vulnerabilities, and we didn't talk about this on the show, but there was a security vulnerability out in the wild called the Poodle attack. It's just weird, but the fix to fixing the Poodle attack was to log into your server and not support SSL version 3. So Chrome has disabled, as of Chrome 39, SSL version 3 to protect all of the people using Chrome. So even if the server supports the old version of SSL and you're using Chrome, you still won't be able to get bitten by the poodle attack. So that is definitely a cool thing to see as Google kind of steps up and in an attempt to protect their users. So that's something that's really nice to see from Google.
And another nice thing to see is that Netflix is launching in March 2015 in Australia and New Zealand.
Cool. That is awesome. I love to see Netflix spread out into a bunch of foreign countries because we just take it for granted that Netflix exists and that it's a pretty good service and that we get to use it here in the United States. So I love seeing them expand out into a couple different countries.
Yeah, we really do. I still don't have my own Netflix subscription, and I get by mostly on watching Netflix with other people, but when that stops working, it's kind of scary. It's, oh no, what do we do now? And then we watch Hulu.
Right. There you go.
Okay, so Apple has some new software updates. They have released iOS 8.1.1 with mostly bug fixes, but the most important or the users for whom this will be most important is going to be users of the older hardware, especially the iPad 2 and the iPhone 4S, to a lesser extent, the third generation iPad and the iPhone 5. It greatly improves performance for older devices. So if your device is feeling slow, this is a good time to update. But of course, if you have jailbroken your iOS device, definitely do not update yet. Don't do it. Your device will become a paperweight.
If you're jailbroken, you'll have to wait for the jailbreakers to jailbreak this version of it, right?
Yes, you do have to wait for that. But you won't have to wait to jailbreak OS X Yosemite because it doesn't exist. And so you can go ahead and update
it's already
to
jailbroken.
10.1, which has some slightly more important bug fixes related to Wi-Fi reliability and Microsoft Exchange servers. So go ahead and update to that if you have time and you're not concerned about software compatibility. Obviously, the people who don't want to update to the latest version of Yosemite probably already know why, but if you don't have any pre-existing qualms about it, go ahead and update to Yosemite 10.10.1. And if you haven't updated to Yosemite, I highly recommend it. My sister just updated, and she thinks that it is ugly, but I'm sure that she will get over it. And so will you.
So Uber and Spotify have announced a partnership where you can queue up a Spotify playlist of some sort, and if you call an Uber, when you get inside of the Uber car, it will in fact be playing the same playlist that you had queued up at home.
So Whoa, almost scary.
That's totally scary. That's pretty crazy. What a great idea. I never would have thought of such a thing, but it totally makes sense. And I would hope that they're looking at other music services for this as well. And I don't know if they have any kind of exclusivity. It would be good to see them roll out some other services too. That said, you know, it's not something I've done yet. So we're going to have to wait and see how it actually works. You know, if this rolls out and the syncing isn't quite right, I could see it being a little bit weird. But they're saying that they're going to roll it out November 21st, which is in just a couple days, to London, Los Angeles, Mexico City, Nashville, New York, San Francisco, Singapore, Stockholm, Toronto, and Sydney. So that is such a cool idea, and I love to see that, despite Uber's bizarre business tactics as of late.
Yeah, I totally agree about that. But what's getting me is the headline of this article: Uber brings Spotify streaming to your morning commute. Who's commuting every day in Uber?
Yeah, that was probably not a good idea to commute via Uber. It's probably not so good. Also,
it's a catchy headline.
I watched the promo video, and they had the Uber guy, the driver, get out and open the door for them. So I don't know.
Maybe, I've had Uber drivers do that.
Oh, yeah? Every time I've used Uber, they haven't done that. But maybe you have to get the black car to do that. Is that right?
No, not necessarily. Some of them just use it as an icebreaker.
Oh, okay. Well, that's nice.
But, you know, it's kind of up to the driver.
Yeah.
I've seen it from other services as well. I mean, even cab drivers do it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, Skype has announced that they're releasing a version of Skype completely for the web. So I guess they're going toe-to-toe with Google Hangouts, kind of in that fashion. So it looks like it's not quite available yet. What is kind of nice is if you're using a Chromebook or if you're using Ubuntu or something, it's quite possible that this new version of Skype would work for those devices. The version of Skype that's been available for Ubuntu is 4.3, is quite old now. So it's kind of cool to see Skype get into the WebRTC realm and get some of their real-time communication stuff working on the web. That's a really, really cool thing to see. And we'll have to see if Skype on the web matches up with Google Hangouts, and maybe we can try a podcast out with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably their goal, right? To go after people who don't have access to the traditional version of Skype. Right. But really, the reason they're doing this here is why not?
Yeah, it's really, I guess maybe they're going after the long tail of devices that have WebRTC capabilities but don't have an application for Skype, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, technologically, we know that devices are capable of that because lots and lots of people are doing it via Google Hangouts or many other services. So why not use Skype for web? It's a natural evolution. You know, it's not that big a deal to go after those long tail users.
So here's a weird headline, Taylor. The U.S. Marshals are going to auction off 50,000 bitcoins, which is about $19 million. And that is from the seizure of the Bitcoins from the Silk Road bust that happened a while back. So they've got all these Bitcoin, and just like any other property that's worth anything, they're going to auction it off. So the U.S. Marshals are in the position of having to auction off all these Bitcoins, and there's going to be a six-hour window on December 4th where you can get your bid in to buy some of these Bitcoins. So it just seemed kind of bizarre, you know, the U.S. government heading into a kind of futurist modern era of cryptocurrency auctions.
I have so many questions about this. Will the government retain the record of the code that the Bitcoin, once they sell it, will they know when you use those Bitcoins to buy something online? If so, why? What is their legal reasoning for doing it? If not, why not? Why would the government willingly give up information? That just doesn't sound like my government at all. How will they distribute the Bitcoins? Will they just have like written scraps of paper with the codes on them?
No, I assume they'll go through some kind of wallet mechanism, but I don't really know.
The government would be implicitly supporting a particular Bitcoin wallet, and that doesn't seem to jibe at all. This is so bizarre from a legal and financial perspective that it's sort of blowing my mind.
Well, they're implicitly acknowledging that Bitcoin is in fact worth something if they are selling it, right?
Well, the IRS has already implicitly acknowledged or explicitly acknowledged that Bitcoin is worth something, that it is an investment rather than a currency. So that doesn't seem new to me. That part is normal. It's just how the government would go about dealing in a currency that was designed to try to avoid government tracking and manipulation is mind-boggling.
Yeah, that is a little bit. Well, speaking of cryptography and security, the mobile pwn-to-own contest for 2014 has happened. It was at the PacSec Applied Security Conference in Tokyo, Japan, and we've got some results. The Amazon Fire Phone went down. The iOS device, the iPhone 5S, as it were, not the most recent one, went down by two bugs in Safari. The Galaxy S5 was targeted via NFC, so you could use NFC to get Bluetooth to pair with something else on the... Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm mixing two things up. So the S5 was exploited via NFC. The Nexus 5 was exploited to pair with a Bluetooth device that it didn't want to pair with. And there were a couple devices left out in the cold. That's the BlackBerry Z30 and the iPad Mini and the Nexus 7. They just weren't targeted at all for some reason. I guess none of the hackers wanted those.
Well, that is a pair of strange bedfellows right there. BlackBerry Z30, the iPad Mini, and the Nexus 7 are not often all mentioned in the same sentence.
And Windows Phone had an exploit where the attacker could get into the all of the cookies off of the phone, and they would be able to get access to that. But they weren't able to break out of the sandbox of the Lumia's browser that they were trying to exploit. So it's always kind of fun slash terrifying to see that all of these devices are so easily compromised from a slight distance. And the mobile phone to own is where that happens. So it's kind of cool to see.
It is very cool to see, but our afterburners are burning up. We need to shut them off.
Yes.
And I'm going to make a gin fizz, Chris.
Yes, please do. So in
okay, so it'll take a little while. So maybe you should get us started with the first the end user story this week.
3 minutes is gin fizz, is that right?
Well, I'll be shaking it for 2 minutes, but it takes okay. A little bit longer than that.
All right. So I wanted to talk a little bit about a couple things that happened in my home network over here. As many of the recurring listeners know, I use Windows Home Server 2011 on my for backups and that kind of thing. So I've actually switched away from Home Server 2011 and into Ubuntu Server. Now, having gone through this experience, I can tell you pretty well that for your average consumer, who it's debatable whether they would get a home server anyway, but for your average consumer, setting up an Ubuntu server is not quite as friendly as Home Server 2011 was. So there's a fair bit of command line foo that you have to go through to get this thing to work. And part of that is because I chose Ubuntu Server instead of Ubuntu Desktop. I bet you if somebody were to install this, maybe it would be my recommendation to install Ubuntu Desktop instead of Server. That way you would get a full graphical interface that you could use instead of just an SSH shell, right? So that can be a little difficult, but anyway, I got it all set up.
Yeah, I was under the impression that aside from the graphical shell, they are basically the same code.
Yeah, they have like the same kernel, and they have the same kind of underpinnings, and just one has a desktop installed. That's all.
Right. So if your server device has the hardware capability of running a graphical interface, it's worth the trouble to go ahead and install regular Ubuntu. You're not losing any features.
Right. Yes. So that was its own little adventure. Now, in setting it up, I realized that one of my three terabyte hard drives that were plugged into this thing was, in fact, giving me death throes. So.
Oh no.
Yes. So one
did
of the drives.
Did you get the click of death?
It was clicking. Yes.
Oh, brutal.
So I've still got it here. I have a external SATA connector that I'm gonna plug in eventually to try and run some recovery tools on it. The only thing that was on there was my movie collection. So all of the video TS rips from the DVDs that aren't encrypted that I own, and I have all of the media for those things. So. That kind of is a backup in and of itself, but it is a lot of work to go back and rip all of those movies again. And we'll see. I'm thinking, maybe it's not even worth it to rip all the movies again. You know, there are many places where I can probably get all of these things, and maybe having them on my home server is not something that's particularly needed anymore, at least for movies.
Sure, yeah. I mean, if you have the physical copies, you probably have access to digital copies. If you have insurance, then they can be recovered or repurchased. What I would recommend, Chris, is to buy a new drive to replace the one that has died.
Definitely doing that.
And back up the rest of your data.
Yes, well, on the other two drives, all of that data is backed up somewhere else as well. I've got it on another external drive That's music and documents. And so those are a bit smaller than the video TS rips. So that's not...
So the one drive that died was the one that happened to be not backed up.
Well, that's how it works, right?
Well, this is a lesson to you, Chris.
Yeah, well, I figure the video TS rips are just so large. I didn't want to go through the hassle of backing them up. So now I guess I have to go through the hassle of re-ripping a lot of this stuff. So we'll see how that goes. Like I said, I may not even do it because of the nature of that data. You know, it made sense a long time ago to go through all of that pain, but it may be the case that I don't have to. So I have to do some sleuthing to see, you know, what of these things that I have on disk are not available for free through something that I own streaming. And I will very at least rip those ones and not the rest of them. So I don't know. We'll see.
Okay.
We'll see how I feel about it in the future here.
Well, how do you feel about Plex Server otherwise?
Yeah, so that was the other thing, is I was able to install Plex Server and play around with that for a little bit. And I got to say, I'm pretty impressed by it. So you, at least for me, at the command line, you execute a command and it installs for you, and it just sets everything up automatically for you. And what it does is it sets up a server and you can access everything via a web browser. Now, I was a little disappointed to figure out that Plex doesn't support video TS, which is what I was just talking about. All of those videos are ripped as. So I'm probably going to have to figure out a way to encode them into MKV or something like that. So I haven't made a decision on how exactly I'm going to do that yet. Now,
Sounds
I could
like an
also
automation job for Ubuntu Server.
Yeah, so I could also encode all of them in something that Plex can read and something that Windows Media Center can read, because I'd like to have access to the movies from both just over the network on a browser and in Windows Media Center. So if I expose the video TS as a network share, Windows Media Center should be able to watch them. So I should be able to at least get that. Now, what worked really well, and now I have a bit more experience with, is the music on Plex was totally seamless and amazing. It went ahead and downloaded all of the metadata on the drive that was mounted on the server, and it was just, you just set it up and it would just fly away and grab all of the useful metadata bits. That part was extremely smooth.
Okay, that's pretty fun. I mean, that's good. I would expect something like Plex Server, you know, it should be able to do that with just about everything.
Yeah, yeah. So
not just music.
I'm still in the playing around phase with both Ubuntu Server and Plex, as it were. You know, I could always go back to Home Server 2011, but I think I'm going to stick with Ubuntu Server. I'm kind of liking it. Now, I got to set up VPN, and I got to set up a couple other things, but I'm well on my way here, and I'm totally impressed by Plex, even though it didn't play video TS. I'm very optimistic that will be a pretty good solution going forward for media consumption outside of the home theater PC running Windows Media Center.
Well, that's great, Chris. For once, I think I may be ahead of you in some ways. I've been running XBMC on an Ubuntu machine for well over a year now.
Oh, yeah. I don't think we ever talked about that setup on the podcast, did we?
Well, it's still a work in progress, and I don't actually use it okay. Every day or even every week or even every month. But when it is set up, I may decide to talk about it on the show.
Yeah, cool. So anyway, that's been my experience of switching over to Ubuntu Server. You know, I have experience with the Linux command line previously, so it wasn't that hard for me. But like I said, if you're a normal person and the command line is a little bit scary, and you're somebody who wants a home server, then I think Ubuntu Desktop would be a little more friendly. So anyway, that's my experience, and it's been kind of fun setting some of this stuff up. It's a whole new home server world for me. So if anybody out there is in the same situation, they're using Ubuntu Server at home as a home server, do let me know if you have any app suggestions or anything like that.
Well, I can give you a few after the show.
Sure. So let's get into a little bit more of the end user stories. We're talking about the Kindle right now, and They've added a feature that allows you to share a lot of the content on your device with your spouse or whoever you're living with, or, you know, at least one person, whoever that person may be. And I'm not sure how they get the rights to do this or if it works with all of the books that are DRM'd or copy protected, but I think it's definitely a very cool feature to add. You know, I just had a situation recently where we had to buy a book twice because I wanted it, and someone else in the household wanted it. So that doesn't seem quite right when you could share, a paperback or whatever. But I think that this pretty much answers that problem, assuming that there's no DRM issues, which is a pretty big assumption.
Right. Well, Apple introduced a really similar feature for all of its media content from the iTunes Store with iOS 8. So Apple's a little bit different scenario in terms of the rights holders, but I feel like this is not necessarily a response to that, but clearly the legal framework for sharing copyrighted work has been paved out somehow, and Amazon is taking advantage of that with Kindle, and this is a popular feature that I've heard people request for years. So this is pretty cool. If you are a multiple Kindle household, this is obviously something that's going to appeal to you immediately.
Now, it's worth noting it supports the Kindle Voyage and the Kindle Paperwhite devices. So anything, I think, Kindle Touch and back will not support this feature.
Oh, wow. But it'll probably support the Kindle apps on all of the other platforms, and I would hope that it supports all of the Kindle Fires with current software on them.
Yeah, I'd imagine eventually that will be true, but I doubt it is true at this very moment.
Oh, well, then let's come back when that's true.
Okay. So anyway, there's also a link in the article we're sharing from TechCrunch here that says, you know, if you don't see the update in your Kindle, then you can go to this webpage and install it manually. So that's a pretty good little tip there if you want to get this feature out.
All right, cool. So what's next, Chris?
So we can get into talking about a brand new Facebook app.
Is it Events? Do they have a Facebook Events app?
No.
Then let's not talk about it. Wait, really? Facebook has another app.
Yeah, so Facebook is making a new app, and it's called Swarm. Sorry, we've used that callback has been overused in this episode. No, they're coming out with a new app. They're splitting out the groups functionality into a brand new application for your shiny smartphone device.
Groups. Okay. I wonder who were the people clamoring Facebook, you know, writing in droves, who really wanted a groups management app. I don't think I've used a Facebook group in so many months or years.
Are you in a Mar group?
Actually, I think I am. Yeah. But it comes in over the regular Facebook app news feed. And that's the thing about Facebook groups is Facebook is saying, if you want to use your news feed, just go ahead and use your news feed.
Yeah, I think I'm definitely in a common Barnes group because that was the thing 1 year on Facebook a long time ago.
Oh, you're talking about old school groups. No, I have one that my family uses to keep in touch, but that's just part of our news feed.
Right.
Okay, so Facebook makes a Facebook app, a Messenger app, a Pages app, Instagram, Instagram Hyperlapse, Instagram Bolt or Jolt or something.
Oh, yeah. What was that app? It was Jolt, wasn't it?
I think so. And now they have groups, but it's still almost impossible to use to get to events in any Facebook app on an iOS device. I don't know what it's like for Android or Windows Phone, but it's entirely too many clicks to get to events, and you still can't see clearly when the event begins and ends, and they don't have full support for maps and directions for any events on any iOS app.
Well, see,
it's crazy. I don't understand their priorities anymore. This is the worst form of app proliferation. If you're going to come up, if you're going to try to take over my whole phone with apps, you have to have the ones that I want.
See, on Windows Phone, I just sync the Facebook calendar with my calendar, and then the events show up on the calendar, so I don't really...
Oh, I have that too, yeah, but it doesn't have all of the information that I want.
Yeah, it doesn't have the information, it doesn't have comments and that kind of thing that are on the Facebook events.
Right, I mean, I do like that I can now see who's RSVP'd to the event on my calendar. That's interesting, but it's not good enough. So this is... app proliferation. It's terrible thing.
I totally agree. I don't see a reason for the groups to go into another app. I remember I was in support of splitting out the Messenger app because I thought that made some amount of sense. But I don't know. I don't think splitting up groups makes a ton of sense.
The I think I was in agreement with you about the Messenger app when it was first released. Now, it's my least favorite of all of them. Pages, I understand and use frequently.
Yeah, that's different.
Groups, I can even get certain chat apps. The Instagram apps obviously make sense because they were a separate company. WhatsApp is now owned by Facebook as well. But Messenger is actually the worst of all of them, I think. And there needs to be an events app.
Or they need to make the experience of events in the Facebook app better.
Yeah, really, they just need to make the Facebook app better, and they need to get rid of all of the other apps, because it's just Facebook. It's not everything. It's just Facebook. This is like when every band and TV show tried to have their own app,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
We are not going to install you on our home screens. We're not going to do it.
Yeah,
We want to get what we want.
Every website in the world has a mobile app that is just the website.
Oh, I'm so glad that Apple has stopped accepting those. It's wonderful that they made that choice for me. I'm being slightly sarcastic, but not really.
Yeah, if somebody went and actually made a real app for the website, that was one thing. But yeah, a lot of people were just kind of like putting a web browser in the app and then having that be their app. It's kind of weird.
Oh, careful, Chris. The Digital Media Zone tried that at one point.
No, we have, so at the DMZ, there's a mobile website that you can go to, and there's also an app for Windows Phone. I haven't used it in a while, so I'm not sure what state it's in, but it was a real application made from scratch with love, and that it was actually a pretty good experience.
I don't think that is quite as true as the Digital Media Zone's iOS app.
It might not be, yeah.
Okay, so... I think we've dragged this topic nearly to death, and now I think it's time for me to revive my green tech segment.
Ah, let's do it.
And this is really almost just a green footnote. I didn't have a lot of great green tech news this week, but I did want to mention that Elon Musk has announced the electric SUV by Tesla. The Model X is now being delayed until... late 2015, and in fact, there are so many pre-orders that if you want to run right now, you may not get one until mid-2016. But they are still selling the Model S.
Right, the Model S, right. Cool, well, that's a little disappointing, but I'm still glad to see Tesla, you know, get out there and do what they do.
Indeed. Well, with that, I think we can move on to our tip of the week. Chris, you have a tip of the week this week, and as ever, it comes from Lifehacker.
So, yeah, this is coming from Lifehacker, as you said, and it is a way to get to Google Inbox if you have the invitation already and you're using it. It only works in Android, iOS, and Chrome. So if you're using something else, then you really can't get to it. So... some intrepid life hacker, either reader who submitted it or the writer who actually did this article, says that if you switch your user agent string, you can actually get to Inbox and it will work in Safari, is the example in the screenshot at least. So,
well, it's worth mentioning that Safari and Firefox have the user agent switcher built in, so you can also do it without a plugin from those browsers.
Yeah, so it's definitely a cool note for people who want to run this somewhere else. It's definitely a hack, so you know you have to remember to switch it back because it might break some other stuff. But you know, some other stuff out on the internet. But it's cool to note that this is possible.
Absolutely, yeah. It's very possible if you already have an invite to Google Inbox, which we don't.
Yeah, that's going to be the hard part, is getting the invite.
It will be. Now, another thing that has always been kind of hard to do, depending on your network setup, is to figure out what other people and devices are on your Wi-Fi network. So our app pick this week is an Android and iOS app called Fing. And it does really something really simple. It locates and identifies all of the devices on the same Wi-Fi network as you. And it's free.
Cool. So it just sniffs out everybody on the network and shows you a list?
Yep. And so it pulls their IP and MAC addresses and does as much as possible to identify where they are on the network, what they're doing, and what type of device they are. And it gives you as much information as possible about each device on the network just from their network identification.
So I'm going to take this into Starbucks and see what happens.
Yeah, I'm sure you'd find out a lot.
Yeah, people will have their iTunes shares open or, you know, something like that. No, not really. In fact, I wonder if Starbucks takes some precautions against that.
Starbucks doesn't take any precautions. I think they just use AT&T Wi-Fi now.
Yes, that's right. In some locations, I've seen both. So anyway, for use on your home network, this is pretty cool. You should note that you can also log into your router most of the time and figure out what's going on. That's what I would do.
Most routers really don't have the kind of user interface that is offered by Fing, which, you know, is pretty good for a free app. I've paid for apps that provide this kind of service just to be able to get network specs and try to figure out what's going on. So if you have an Apple router or a really nice router, or maybe you've installed Tomato or DDWRT on your router, you can get access to all of these stats. But if you have a rented router or an off-the-shelf router, you may not have access to this. And maybe you want to see if, you know, one of your neighbors is snooping on your Wi-Fi, and this is a way that you can find that out or figure out any number of other things. You know, you can check if your printer is on the network or if it's gotten kicked off. Or maybe your Sonos is acting up, and you can check whether its connection is good enough to play music.
Yeah, it's definitely a handy thing to have in a mobile sense. So, Taylor, I've got one more app pick of the week, and I just installed it, and it is the DigitalMediaZone.com's Windows Phone client. And I've been thumbing around it right while we were on the podcast here just to make sure everything was working like it used to. I haven't had it installed for a while, so that's my second app pick of the week.
Cool. So see if you can go on there and find our Twitter handles.
Yes, I believe I can look at the show notes from last week. And, oh no, I don't think we have the Twitter handles in there.
No.
So maybe we should fix that.
Maybe.
But if somebody wanted to contact you on Twitter, what is your Twitter handle?
Well, they'll have to go to the Windows Phone, the Digital Media Zone app,
yeah,
and find out once we fix it.
Right, exclusively.
Yeah.
So how about, what's your LO handle? How about that one?
Well, that would lead people to my Twitter handle. I don't want to make it that easy for them. What's your Twitter handle?
Oh, well, I'm at Chris Hale Barnes. I don't mind giving it out without a mystery and a riddle.
Okay, fine. I don't want you to have more followers than me. So I'm at Taylor Phone.
All right. Well, I'll have to follow you.
You don't follow me, Chris?
No. I'm just kidding. Of course I follow you. It's that Twitter unfollow bug, right? That's always the old excuse, right?
Oh, yeah. I hear that's going around. It's catching like wildfire.
Yeah. All right. Well, before we delve into the Twitter unfollow bug, I think it's time to get out of here. We're going kickerless this week, so it's time to get out of here. So thanks, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. You can also use the DMZ Windows Phone app, as we discovered tonight. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0 and Home On. There's a great Home On episode with open source home automation this week. If you listen to it, it's a really good one. You can also send us some feedback. We've got our email. It's theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. We are @theenduser. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Mott.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.